Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahagiryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastamavivishavahai Shanti, Shanti, Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare
Okay, continuing the discussion on Bhagavan. Innumerable opposites, the Lord's free will and his unchangeable nature. His qualities and absence of qualities, nirguna. Because he has all spiritual qualities and is the basis of all the qualities even that's working within the material world, but he has no material qualities, right? Because material means it's a quality that's being manifest, it's not connected to the Lord. It means it's not consciously. Of course, everything is connected to the Lord. But what we're dealing with here is the consciousness of the living entity. So, therefore, from the living entity's point of view, he's nirguna, because he has no material qualities. His inconceivable nature, achintya, and his attainment by the devotee. He's inconceivable. You can't understand him. At the same time, the devotee can attain him, control him by his love, get to, you know, interact in so many ways. His neutrality and favoritism to his devotees, all these coexist within the Lord. Right? So he's neutral towards everybody, but at the same time, he's favorable to the devotee. So he's interacting with everyone how they interact with him. So within the material world, that's always going to be non-favorable. Right? It means it's an interaction, but it's, you know, give me this, give me that, or they don't like God, or, you know, some other aspect. It's another. But the devotee, he interacts favorably to the Lord, so that response is favorable. You know what I'm saying? So he's equal to everyone, but he's special to the devotees. Because the thing is for the materialist, it's just how you reciprocate. But this element of working on the platform of love, where you actually control the Lord, that's by the Lord's grace. So that's the special favor. All these coexist within the Lord harmoniously. Who can find difficulty in accepting the simultaneous identity and difference arising from internal and external perspectives? That means if you're open, then it makes very, very great sense. And it all makes a lot of sense. The difficulties, the modes of nature, make it where one can't understand it. Right? They cover one, so one's not interested. Right? Yes.
In one sense, to understand that, it's like a grace, a mercy.
Yes, it's by the Lord's mercy that you can understand. But you have to want to understand, to be open to understand. In other words, you have to be favorable to the association of devotees. If that's there, then everything else will follow. But if you're not favorable to the association of devotees, then there'll be no benefit. So if someone, no matter how, you know, devotional they are, but if they appreciate devotees, then they're still in a good position. Because it's just a matter of time that develops. So you don't have to worry about trying to cultivate specifically the understanding of the Lord, as long as they appreciate the devotees. So you keep them off the topic that's outside of that. You keep them within, being practical and things like this. So that association, then he'll become purified, he'll become favorable. Because if you like the devotees, you like what the devotees do. It's just time. So. So a simultaneous identity and difference. Those who propound absolute dualism are mistaken, as those who propound absolute monism. Okay? Because the point is the absolute dualism, we notice that Madhvacharya, when he's speaking, he's speaking absolute dualism. But he's only speaking it in context of the material world. Because we see when it gets into the spiritual world, then interaction within the spiritual world and what he says and what Ramanuja says aren't really any different. He might choose a different word, but at that point it becomes the same. But the point is the Mayavadis haven't gotten to there. So as long as there's Mayavadis involved, which means in the material world, then he doesn't give any space for any concept of anything other than dual. Right? The concept of identity just doesn't come into the picture. But as soon as you get into the spiritual world and the relationship with God there and the devotees, then it's indirectly indicated. It means you can see by reading it that's what he's talking about, but the words he's discussing are still not necessarily indicating that. Does that make sense? Like that. So even though you say he's the absolute dualist, that's only within the material sphere. Right? So within the spiritual, then that identity is accepted. Right? So then you have both. But it's just because the monist is so absolute identity, so therefore he's taking absolute duality, dualism, just to counter it. You know, it's a tactic. Does that make sense? In other words, it's been some hundreds of years that Ramanuja and his followers have been preaching. So those who didn't become impressed with that, then these are the real hard cases. So Madhva comes and then deals with them in a very hard-lined way. Does that make sense? So one should never put this mistake on Madhvacharya. Right? The Lord with his own form is different from the universe and all the souls, but by his energies he establishes the eternality and reality of the souls and the universe. For this reason, the Vedas sometimes make monistic statements and sometimes dualistic statements. But with his own form is different from the universe and all souls. He is different. He is a different entity. He's the source of all other entities. So that's the difference. Right? Other energies may expand and this and that, but there's still energies, but he's energetic. So that means anything that we actually understand, he's different from that. At the same time, through his energies, he's the same, because him and his energies are the same. So therefore, then, we can see his energies everywhere and that oneness of everything. Right? So that's why Shastras will sometimes talk dual, and sometimes they'll talk monistic. But the point is they both exist simultaneously. Right? So the person has both. That's the difficulty. You could say, you know, because just as if you have Brahman, it can't have qualities in the materialistic sense. So in the same way as the person can't have the monistic elements. But that's what sets him apart from everybody else. The realization of Bhagavan is the culmination of the realization of Brahman and Paramatma. Because then you're going to beyond this. So that's what's special, because it's easy enough to describe Brahman and Paramatma. Right? You could basically describe that to any variety of materialist or religionist. If you just deal with one or the other, and say that he does both, they're fine. You say he's a person, most will be happy with that. But when you start to get into detail of that and how he's, you know, everything is non-different, then they can't understand. Right? That's where it falls apart. So the personal element that they get into maximum is actually Paramatma. Like that. A localized aspect, not an interactive aspect.
It's in monistic element.
Yeah, so they fall back into the monistic. It means there's the touch of the personal, but their actual understanding is monistic. It's mixed, because there's just lack of training, so then it comes out that way.
So these two elements, monistic and dualistic, it's only for Krishna, also for living entities.
Living entities, there means it is. They're non-different from Krishna because as energy, but as energetic, they're different. But the point is this form of the monism and dualism, the jiva is not the source of it. Krishna is the source. That's what sets him apart. Does that make sense? But in any case, if he's non-different from his energies, then the jiva being an energy is non-different from the Lord. If the Lord is different from, you know, everything, he's apart, then that means the jiva is different.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So it applies to both, but the center of it is still Krishna, not the living entity. Right? In other words, the monistic and dualistic is not an aspect of the mundane vision. Right? That only the mundane vision sees in that way. No, both of those are there, because Mother Yashoda, is Krishna different from her or not? Means is he her son, or they're exactly the same? They're different. But he's her son, so then that emotionally they're the same. So it's always, these two aspects are always there. Problem is, if you take only the one, then it doesn't have that sweetness. And if you take the other ones, then there's no interaction at all. So in other words, by not understanding, accepting both, you compromise rasa.
Yes.
Like that.
Which means what, for example, when parents can have with his son or daughter, two dualistic and monistic.
There's both of them. Means in a relationship, both are there. Means you have a relationship, it's like something's common. That's the basis. But at the same time, if you're not two people, how do you interact based on
that? Yes.
Right? Like that. So, you know, there's subtle points, but we're used to hearing them in connection just with the Mayavad.
Yes.
But the point is, the Mayavad, it's not that it's just oneness, it's only just oneness. So it's exclusive oneness. Mm-hmm. So you're only accepting, which is true, there is oneness, but there's not exclusive oneness because there's the dualistic also. Right? The dualistic is correct, but there's also the oneness. So the point is when you understand them both, and how they function harmoniously together, that's Vaishnava. If you only accept one or the other, then you're dealing with some variety of material vision. Right? Like that. Or predominantly one and a touch of the other. No, it has to be they're both correct. Right? So therefore, simultaneous one and difference, that achintya, because how these opposites are together, that's achintya. Right? So that's the. So therefore, it perfectly explains any philosophy. Right? In other words, whatever is the weakness in any philosophy, then Achintaveda Veda Tattva can fill it in and show what its balanced actual form is. But then when it takes that balanced form, then its natural form is the Vaishnava manifestation. Yes?
You're talking about Paramatma realization. Is it necessary to actually understand who the Paramatma is, or it's just, it can be, like in Christianity, everything is a little vague, ambiguous, it's not, they don't...
Means, understand correct in relation to...
Philosophically.
No, but for who?
For Christians, particularly, I'm thinking of Christians.
Christians, the more they understand these things, the more then they'll be able to function nicely, because otherwise, you end up with inconsistencies, right? Because let's take the term Catholic. Catholic means broad, all accommodating. But we see in their history when they were in a position of power, they weren't necessarily very accommodating. You know, so there's contradictions there. Even though if you sit and discuss the emotions, the feelings and all that, that's the intent, to be broad, because the idea is, you know, everybody can embrace God, everybody can embrace Jesus, everybody, you know, is welcome into the fold. But if you're not doing that, then they have, if their vision's so narrow that you're excluded. You know, so there's problems there. So when they understand if, because then there's the element that there's, you know, this God and then there's that God. But the point is if you actually understand God, you can't have more than one God. You know, so that's a difficult. How do you have that there's a Christian God and there's a Jewish God, there's a Muslim God, how Hindu God? What does that mean? It's not logical. There can only be one. So their understanding of how the Lord is involved, how he's involved, his divinity, and all that. So because they tend to either make the flesh divine or deify. They can't actually get a balance. So this understanding of Brahman Paramatma can give more of a balance. If they understand it, great. But, you know, otherwise, then, you know, just understand the Vedanta philosophy and then it'll all come into, it'll naturally. But within their own tradition may be difficult because they don't have the, they have really, really well thought out words to express an exact thing. But it's not necessarily that there's a common mood that they're trying to find a word for. It's generally to find the word so it differs from another branch. You know, that's the so. But they have amazing words for their in their theology. But the problem is then the definitions of that word is weak. Though the word is very, really amazing words that they come up with. You never hardly even hear of them. You know. Is that? Because the principle, it's not hard for them to understand Brahman and Paramatma. That's easy enough for everybody. Like that. But you have to basically approach it from the impersonal qualities. When you start getting into, you know, he's the size of the thumb sitting in the heart, he's got four hands, that's when they start freaking. Because that's actually, when we're describing that, that for us, that's the Bhagavan platform. Because for let's say for the yogis, they can, either they understand as Bhagavan, but even if they don't, they just think that this is the form to meditate on, and ultimately then it's personal. So because most of these religions are all impersonal, the detail, they're not used to that, and that kind of meditation, because for them, then meditation on something, you know, as God was, you know, if you go back thousands of years, was pretty standard for them, but it was imaginary. It wasn't an authorized form, so they just make them up. And so to stop them from just speculating and making them up forms of God, then they basically throw out the whole concept that there is an appropriate form. You know, it's just like with the you know, like Madhva and the Mayavadis. You can't deal with any element of oneness. It has to be just two. So in the same way, it's because of the tendency of the particular class of people, therefore, you have to be so hard-line on this. But being hard-line, then... unless there's a tradition of handing down the proper understanding, then they don't catch it. It gets lost. You know, so they can't understand how the Lord has a form and is transcendental. So they'll have big problems there. But then the Brahman and Paramatma, but the more they understand it, the more they'll be able to function better.
They always talk about personal relationship.
They talk about personal relationship, but they say, what's that personal relationship? Personal relationship, I want my, you know, son to pass his exams. And God fulfills it. That's the personal relationship. What about doing something for God? You know, okay, I'm serving mankind. Okay, great. That's because it belongs to God. That's like, okay, I'll wash God's car. Right, but what about interacting with God and personally doing something for God or with God? That they don't talk about. It's just not talked about. But it means you read about it for half a page or something even less. Yeah, maybe half a page, probably less though. With Adam and Eve, that's it. And they don't even refer to that. You know, I guess that's the broad-mindedness that they even accept the Old Testament. Right? But there's no real understanding of a personal relationship. They talk about it. It sounds great. That's the whole thing. I mean, it's just like anything. You know, you can talk about it. The guy who calls you up on the phone to try to, you know, sell your place in the Pocomos. You know, it sounds great. But in reality, you go up there and it's nothing special like that. So it's unfortunately, though, the intent is great, but their understanding is not, so they can't actually deliver it. And if some individual is able to appreciate it, then that's by God's grace. But it's not necessarily by the direct presentation. It doesn't seem to function. You know what I'm saying? But there's so many elements of common ground that you can talk on those and avoid all the ones that make them uncomfortable. Because the point is you're trying to develop that they should want to develop love for God and identify as a servant of God and as the soul, you know, not the body. Because generally most of those things, if it's said properly, they'll catch. Like that. Because you say, you know, you're the soul, not the body, they'll say yes, but then they bury the body because you got to take it with you. You know? Yeah, what to do? The realization of Bhagavan is the culmination of the realization of Brahman and Paramatma. Their development depends on secondary processes of jnana and karma. And they are therefore incomplete realizations of the Lord, right? So jnana and karma then is dependent in dealing here. That's why it's so easy to use these as platforms to discuss. But they're incomplete. So unless you introduce the personality of Godhead, then it's not a complete understanding. Realization of Bhagavan is only possible through the process of pure bhakti, which reveals the Lord's real form directly to the devotee. Right? So now you're talking about it. So the idea is there, but they have to do it through bhakti. Because what they're trying to do it is through karma, or the theologians maybe through jnana. But there's not the idea of actually doing it through bhakti. So there'll be a sense of bhakti, but how do you know what is bhakti? Okay, I'm feeding the people, and that will be, and I'm nice to them, and compassionate to the poor, and the sick, and the, you know, like that. So they'll take that as that's bhakti. You know, that's just piety. That's being nice. So even if you say it's bhakti, but it's bhakti directed at, you know, the mortalness of the human being. It's not actually directed as the soul. So then if you say, no, but we're giving Jesus and that's there. But still, okay. But it's then still just connected to. But what about God himself as the person? And he says, no, but Jesus is the person. So what are you going to do for Jesus? What are you actually as service going to do?
Tell people about it. That's my service.
But that's okay. That's telling, but that's nice. But it's, if we see as the, you know, apostles did a little more. Yes. Mary Magdalene at least washed his feet. You know what I'm saying? You know, anointed him with oil, dried his feet with her hair, did something. So just telling about him is great, but what are you telling about? So everyone's just going to tell him, that's it? What about, is anybody ever going to interact with him? So he's got this whole planet, you know, telling each other about him, but nobody's about to interact with him. You know, you got too much things to do with your own wife and kids. You know, why, where's the time to interact with Jesus? You know?
When we go to heaven.
When you go to heaven, and what's happening there? It's nice to say that. What happens there?
Nice music, angels, grandma's there.
Grandma's there. Forgot the dog. And the talking lions. For the dog. Yeah, but then where's Jesus? God's out of the front door simply with no face in a big monster chair and pointing this way or that way. And then you walk around the chair, and behind the chair there's a door. And once you walk through that door, hey, you know, God's outside. We're inside, you know. So, but then actually if you look at it, then you start to wonder, is it God outside and we're inside? Or we're outside and God's inside? You know, you didn't want to interact with God, so okay, you go behind the seat, there's a door, you can hang out there in the rec room, you know. You know, what happens after everybody goes through the door, you know, then he just sits there alone. Then now what does he do for eternity? You know?
He keeps score of the sins and you can help him.
No, but once everybody's resurrected, it's done. It's the final judgment day. You know, there's no sequel, you know. That's only in Hollywood, right? You know, here, it's the final judgment day. Now, if you're looking at it that every soul is being judged at the moment and goes to heaven or hell at that point, after his lifetime, you know, like that, then you can talk about a continuity. He's got something to do. But otherwise, it's no, everyone's just getting buried since the last couple of thousand, some thousands of years, and then, you know, there'll be that great getting up morning, and then, you know, then you're, you know, hoping the chariot will get close enough to get on. You know, all these different things. There's varieties of, you know, sin, you know, songs to you know, express the sentiment, and then that's it.
We'll find out when we get there.
That's there, but the point is we're talking about you can find out now. In other words, if you're in ignorance, how do you know you're going to get there? How do you know you're going to get there?
Faith,
but faith in what?
His word.
His word, and what was his word?
Believe me and you'll get there.
Believe, that's all he says. Just believe me and you'll get there. There's nothing else. He didn't say anything else.
That's the Paribhasa Sutra, have faith in me. Everything else is...
Okay, but then if that's there, if everything is secondary, when you get there, everything else is secondary also, because the faith... You have the faith, but then now that you have faith, won't you do something? It's just like, let's say, the man has faith in his country. What does he do? Right? He joins the military. He goes and fights. You know, he has faith in money. What does he do? He goes and makes some. He has faith in his music. What does he do? He expresses through that. You know, his faith in his family and his community. Then he's interactive. So if we say we have faith, then shouldn't we be interactive? Especially if we throw it in your previous point of the personal relationship. So that's the whole thing, is that yes, all that's true, but the point is it's not complete, the understanding. So how do you know that that's exactly what you like? Because what they do talk about in the spiritual world, or in heaven, you don't necessarily that, is just the interaction with your own family and friends. They don't talk about interaction with God or with Jesus. You know, you don't say that, you know, your God will be there. You're on the little boat on the lake, and she's there playing with her talking, you know, lion, and Jesus is walking by with a few apostles, and you wave, and he waves back. And, you know, they don't talk about anything like that, because they don't know. That's all. And better they don't talk about it. It would just get worse. As it is, it's bad enough. If they talk about it, it would get worse. You know, so. Yeah.
So are they somewhere between Brahman and Paramatma? Or are they in their own tattva?
No, these are the only things they have. It means they're in the realm of theistic morals. But the point is, the morality is more important than actually God. Because that's the point. Theism is there, but it's all about the morality. It's not about God. Because the point is, if everybody's a soul of, you know, a God, everybody's, you know, brother and all this, but then why then they deal so roughly with each other? So it's all about the morality. It's not about God himself. Mason, laws of God. So in other words, the elements are there, but the elements aren't put together in a way that makes it complete. You know, that's the difficulty. Because if, you know, it's like, okay, you know, when you get into something, okay, God spoke to Abraham, right? God spoke to Moses. I don't remember if God spoke to Isaac or Jacob, but I know those three at least spoke to. Okay. And Jesus spoke to his apostles. Then the point is the effect of God speaking to Abraham and Moses was the start of and the continuance of the Judaic tradition. And Jesus talking to the apostles, they also were continuing the tradition. So then, where did every last ritual that they perform now in Christianity, where did it come from? Because it didn't come from God. It didn't come from Moses. It didn't come from Jesus, because Jesus was Jewish. You know? So where did all that come from? So in other words, they are trying to take the spirit that has been given But the application of that spirit is going to be through their own conditioning, what they'll consider to be nice, not what God has specifically authorized. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So then...
Well, what do you do if you don't have a contra-retreating system? They have nothing to refer to, so they had to make something up, right?
But the point is Christianity didn't have to make anything up. Christians are Jews. That's all. Christians are Jews. You know, so every time they just make something up. So then they make it up, and after 1,000 years, they have something pretty, you know, everybody's comfortable with. But then after 1,000 years, then you get the Protestants coming up, and that, and then they reject that, and then they again make everything new. You know? So that's the problem. As you see, it takes on the flavor of the particular place. You know, and that becomes the Christianity. You know, it has, the church looks like that, and that, but it's European. You go to the East, and it looks like, you know, the Byzantine, that era, like that. And so it takes on the flavor of the area. It's okay that people are engaging the flavor in the Lord's service in their personal life, but you know, where's the direction? So the point is, the only thing that's actually directly could say it came from God and was practiced by God was the Judaic element. So that's what I'm saying, is that if they're going to get into detail, is that where does this detail come from? Who authorizes this detail? So then, if you want to just stick to principles, we won't bring this point up. We won't point it out that actually how do you, the only thing you can say that makes you Christian is your faith. But it seems like, you know, apostolic Christianity was a lot more than just faith. There was traditional ways of expression of that faith. But otherwise, the modern ways are, let's say, the non-Jewish ways are just ways that have worked for the person. He felt that meditative aspect, or felt the presence of God like that. So that's all. So they would sing songs. They just changed the songs. You know, but, you know, so in that way you could say that there's a connection. That's why they're finding something. But thank you. But the problem is that it's all speculative. So that's our point, is that the element of when you're dealing with God in heaven, it seems to be a bit speculative. That's the weakness. You know, it's not about, you know, otherwise then you go back to, you know, okay, well, who did interact with God? You know, so what are these interactions? Right? So now, okay, a burning bush, okay, that works. You know, but then the difficulty comes is that, but what about personal interaction? We're talking personal. Personal is Adam and Eve. So they walked with God, they talked with God. So that's not discussed, walking and talking with God. You know, so... You know, that kind of what is spiritual life, that's not discussed. You know, what piety you should do here to obtain it, you know, but the thing is what's there? You know what I'm saying? It's just heaven, it's nice and all this, but they're only talking about it's a natural environment and stuff like that. I mean, at least with the Muslims, you get some couches to sit on, you know? But, you know, the Christians stand up all the time, you know, it's like, you know, Muslims will sit down to eat and stuff, but Christians don't mind standing up and partying and sitting, walking around, and people come and serve on things and just stand there and eat. So does that mean they don't have couches? Because Muslims, you know, prefer sitting, so therefore God gives them couches? I mean, how does this work? You know, so it's kind of amusing. So the theology is...
They would argue... Well, you don't need to know that. You just need to follow what God wants and you get there.
But how do you know you're following what God wants? Because the problem is then something that was taken as direct Christian. Now, all those who followed Origen and believed in other words, for 300 years, Christians believed in reincarnation. And the divinity of Christ didn't mean that God and Christ were one person. So now, are any of those Christians from that first 300 years, are they going to go to heaven, or are they all destined for hell? And if they're going to heaven, then what's wrong with the philosophy? And if you say, well, they're heretics, they're going to hell, then what's the connection between 400 AD Christianity and the apostolic?
Well,
That means everything in between is a speculation. So how do you even know what apostle? How do you even know what Christianity is? So just to say you have the faith, but who said that's all that's necessary? You're saying it's like, but who says that's all that's necessary? Because you can't do anything else with just faith. You have to have faith plus knowledge plus endeavor. Right? So why is it in this? It's just faith. Just faith, and then go on living your just ordinary, mundane life, and somehow or another, that's good enough.
You can't reach God by karma.
But they don't say that.
Your works are like filthy rags, I think, or something like that. And that's what they quote.
So if it's just like filthy rags, then somehow or another, the authorities of the church are wearing some pretty good filthy rags, you know? You know, saying, yes, it's like that. So that means it's not the work, it's the devotion while you do the work. But if you throw out the work, then that's impersonal. How do you express love without work? If you don't have work, how do you express it? So the work itself, if you think by doing the work, by expertise in doing the work, that's gets it. That's the whole point. The reason Jesus ended up on the cross is because basically his followers and everybody else couldn't understand what he's talking about. You know? No one should feel that it's the Jews that put him there and that everybody else is squeaky clean. Who understood what he's talking about? Otherwise, why would you say that? The work itself alone, that by my material skill and by my material knowledge, I'll thank God, yes, that's correct, you won't. But you have to use your material knowledge and skill in connected with God, with that faith in God. You have to have that combination. So when you just say faith without work, but then the point, if it's only faith, then why are you out on the street? Why do you have a job? Why do you have a family? Because if it's only faith, those early Christians that actually took it up, that were not Jewish, you know, then they didn't have any families. They didn't have any culture. All they did was wore black, burlap sacking. And, sat around and who knows what they did, throw rocks at Jews. You know, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot that they did. Then, because that they can't function on that way, then they introduced that everybody could just go on being their good old material selves, and if you have faith, then that's all that's good, that's all you have to do. You know, so how much is that? You have the priest is in the church praying all the time, and you have somebody that maybe on Sunday they'll remember. So they get the same result. If they do get the same result, what do you need the church and so much heavy stuff? You just preach once a week, go to church, and, you know, try to think of God there. And the rest of the time, you know, try not to bother everybody else. It's God's creation. But, so why teach all this more fervent thing if you don't get some more benefit for it? You know, so what's the meaning?
What they'll say is, by faith you'll make it, but you should do what God wants, and you should do the service and follow Him. But if you're not able to, or you don't do it so well, still.
But you'll still get exactly the same result, yeah. So it's all one. So, it's just all mercy. So that means, what is that all one that everybody's doing? Because it still hasn't been explained what you'll do there.
That they don't explain, but it's like, we're brothers, we're all going to get the inheritance.
So then if we're all brothers, then why the Crusades? And why when the Christians took over Jerusalem, they killed every man, woman, and child? That does not fit what you're saying. They believed in God. They say there's only one God. And you slaughter them down to the smallest child. That's not Christianity. That's not what God asked you to do. So if we take in history, millions of people died because they're not brothers. And now you're going to say everybody's brothers. You know, that doesn't fly. You know what I'm saying? That Roman, the centurion who believed, had faith in Jesus, but he still lived his life as a Roman. But he had faith in Jesus, but he still lived that. So you'd say he's a different lifestyle. He's different. So all you're talking about is cultural differences. Right? The God of Abraham is the same God for Muhammad, is the same God for the Jews. It's the same one God. So then, but you're dealing as if it's different gods, and that people, everybody is not actually son of God, or, you know, or whatever it is, belong to God, whatever term you want to use. So it's nice to use these really hard-line emotional things, but then that's the problem, because of lack of philosophy and understanding, then as the emotions peak, then they have wars and they kill each other. So then the point is if Jerusalem is God's place, it is Abraham's place, so all three religions, then they're connected to Jerusalem. So then why can't they all just live there peacefully together? You know, you prefer this ritual. I mean, it's just like within Christianity. There's major divisions of things that each one considers the other one's going to hell. So which branch of Christianity actually is going to heaven? Is East going? Is Orthodox going? Is the Protestant going? You know, what about the guys that jumped out before any of this? You know, what about the Oriental? You know, and then within that, you know, so all, it means that they're all cool? You know, so it doesn't make sense. It means that it sound, what's being spoken is really nice. And it's correct. But the problem is without the proper understanding of philosophy, it's not actually being applied. It's just really not being applied. You know, there's individuals who do a nice job and everything like that, but when it comes to, you know, affecting it on a greater scale, it doesn't come out very good. That's the difficulty. Is that they don't know how to connect the emotions and everything to God. The point is, you know, God can wipe out all these people. He doesn't need you to do it, so why you have to get involved? You know what I'm saying? You know, Jews got a little out of hand. He sent all those, you know, poison birds. You know, that was, you know, wiped them all out. You know, so it's easy enough. God's God. He can do it. He can take care of it. He doesn't need us to go and do all that. You know, talk compassion on one side, and then you're slaughtering babies. You know, so I say, you know, give me a break. You know. So that's the problem, because of the understandings and the mode of passion. Therefore, you think the souls are different, but they're not different souls. God's one person, so the nature of souls is one also. You know? Of the church is always established by theologians, not by the, how you say, your general priest. And there's a lot of difference talking to the two. Theologians, you can actually talk to philosophy, you know, like that. And they're much more cultural. In fact, the preachers and that, then they have faith, which is the whole point. They have faith, they can give faith. But they don't know philosophy, so they can't give philosophy. So anything that they can't understand immediately, then it's the devil. Like that. But then then that's the fun part, is then isn't that the same as superstition? Superstition is I don't understand it, then you know, you feel there's something strange about it. Point is knowledge means you understand it, so therefore you can accommodate it. You know where it fits. Well, there is if I understand it, then I get involved in it. But it's a matter of I get understand it, I don't get involved in it. Because I know where it fits. I know its place. You know, in other words, idol worship is better than not accepting that this is supreme at all. But it's not a very developed concept, because it's just you make it up in your imaginary, you know, so everyone can make up some different deity. So, yes, if you want to establish the monotheism, you have to understand this is supreme. But the point is that's who the person you're looking for. Right? But they're trying to approach the same person, but through their, you know, made-up deities, like that. So if we accept that there's only one God, that means there's only one God. You can't have it both ways. There's only one God, and then, you know, so everybody's all brothers at the same time, is then, oh, they're different, so then they're pagans, and then pagans can be killed.
Seems like they're satisfied just understanding that God is the Creator, the Father.
Yeah. Well, that's this platform of realization that we're talking about, is that the theistic moralism is good enough for them. That's all the farther they want. Because there's a satisfaction that you will go someplace in the future. There's a meaning to doing good work now. Everybody else is not doing, but I'm doing. So I have the satisfaction of what the benefits I'll get. So it does. It makes society work better. It gives more peace and satisfaction to the individual. That's already been established. But you can't take that and oppose the absolute understanding of the Supreme Lord on the transcendental platform. That is not to be done. So it's good. It's a progress. You know, we've already come up two levels of consciousness. But the point is there's still two more to go.
It's like Prabhupada would say, if you don't accept Krishna as God, tell me who is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't say anything.
Yeah, yeah. So, Eric Clapton. I mean, it's just, you know, who is this? You know. Yeah. Because that's the thing, it's just a matter of, we're talking facts here. So, what is... You know, these things are very good because they just totally unnerve them. The Krishna's not, but who is? And if they claim that they're a little logical and scientific, then, you know, that's a good point. You know, we can show how he is, so, you know, but you have to disprove it. So. Okay, an object realized in its true form, as it is a real object. The object's real form is not identified. It is realization of only some of the qualities of the object. So here's the thing. You're only understanding some points of God. The essential or intrinsic form of Brahman and Paramatma are not identified in their respective realizations. They are satisfied with the realization of some qualities of the real object. Therefore, they cannot be given the main position. They are secondary manifestations of Bhagavan, attained by secondary functions of the soul. Bhagavan is an object of all the functions of the soul. The Lord of all functions includes them all, and thus yields the vision of the Lord as he is. With the realization of the real form of God, all the dependent functions are satisfied. Right? So the true form, meaning is the true form of Brahman, it's the effulgence of the qualities of Krishna. The true form of Paramatma is a partial expansion of the Lord for the maintenance of the creation. Creation, maintenance, and destruction. And so just see that it all goes on nicely. So if that's there, then you're getting a full. So that brings you to Bhagavan. But if you don't accept the Bhagavan aspect, then you're only getting certain aspects of it. And then it's like it says, but they are satisfied with only just some of that. Because that's all the more they want to know about God. Because, you know, the family is there, and business is there, and friends, and, you know, recreation, and all that. And that's more important. So that's the element.
So, yes. What did you say about the true form of Paramatma?
The true form of Paramatma is he's in a partial, you know, plenary expansion of Krishna to carry on the functions of the material world. Because he doesn't have to manifest much potency to do it. Because as Lakshmiji was saying, is that a, you know, billionth of a billionth or of that. If you take all the energy, the Srup Shakti, and a billionth of that, and then that part take a billionth of that, that's how much energy it takes to run the material world. And that means the whole thing, the one quarter of the, you know, the cosmic manifestation. So it's not a whole lot. So therefore it's a plenary portion of Krishna. It means he's a complete Godhead, but the amount of energy that he's manifesting, you know, is very small compared to what he manifests as Bhagavan in the spiritual world. Because if Bhagavan, then you interact with the devotees based on affection. So that uses the full potency of Godhead. But to run the world. We think this place is so amazing and intense. So the intensity of the spiritual world will be so much greater. The amazing, everything is so much more. Okay, so the Bhagavan and the Paramatma came by secondary functions of the soul. You know, engaging the nature of the elements of karma and jnana with naishkarmya and knowledge. This way you can understand. Still by God's grace, but these are what's expected. It means, in other words, God will reveal these forms by these activities. But if you want to know Him as He is, that requires bhakti. Types of Bhagavan realization. There are four types of realization of Bhagavan. A. Realization dominated by karma. B. Realization dominated by jnana. C. Realization dominated by both karma and jnana. And D. Pure realization. As long as the living entity has not relinquished his bondage to the material world, the activities for realization of the Lord as Bhagavan are not identical for all people. Those who perform bhakti with the mind intent on action receive a realization of Bhagavan, which is influenced by that interest, which is known as karma pradani bhutanubhava.
What is that?
How you say it? All the Sanskrit terms. Like that. Those who perform bhakti with the mind dominated by knowledge receive a realization of Lord influenced by knowledge, which is known as jnana pradana bhutanubhava. Those who perform bhakti with both karma and jnana influences receive realization of the Lord influenced by both. When those persons become liberated from material bondage, the three types of realization are apparent in the form of the Lord that appears to them, a form regarded with reverence. Their goal is to live on the same planet, attain similar opulence, and live near the Lord. Those who practice Raghunuga bhakti during sadhana realize the purest form of the Lord. So these elements of karma and jnana, then they still have the... that still is an appearance of the Lord, though the devotee is beyond. That's why we're mentioning it's important what you do here influences what will be your position there. Because if the karma and jnana remain as a prominent element, then one will go to the realm where that kind of prominent element is therefore the medium of interaction. So when the idea is that pure devotion, then that the Raghunuga means the spontaneous, that you're doing it because you want to do it to please God. Because otherwise what's happening is I'm doing what I should. I'm remembering God. I have faith in God. Okay, but then how does that matter? How do we know the nature of that faith? That it's just what we just have, or you just know. Nice, but how do we know it manifests? It's just like it doesn't fly in the world that you say, well, my family should know that I have love for them, but they never see the father, he never comes around, he doesn't necessarily ever send them any money or any interaction, but, you know, he, in his heart, he loves them. How are they supposed to know? Right? You know, they say, well, God just knows. Well, then God just knows, and then what's the meaning of the whole process in the first place? You know, what are you supposed to do? God's already perfect. So the point is we're the ones that are not perfect. So then how to prove that you're becoming perfect?
That said, what you read, didn't it say that the different processes, you realize the different aspect of God, a different form, what did it say?
Well, this is all within Bhagavan. Yes, well, it basically is making a distinction between basically Vaikuntha and Goloka.
Yes. But then there's four division, four different aspects of
God?
Yeah,
the D is Goloka. A, B, C is Vaikuntha. Right? Just like you see Krishna in the Gita, he's already explained A, B, and C. A is chapter 3, B is chapter 4, and C is chapter 5. So this establishes religion. Then in the 18th chapter, he says, give that up. Right? In other words, that the importance of karma or jnana, or the combination, is the important element in your life, give that up. Make just him the important element. Right? So that doesn't mean one's not performing the activities that might be designated as karma and jnana. You know, you're using your intelligence or you're using the senses. But you're doing it simply to please Krishna. So that's the rag part. So ultimately, that has to be given up. Otherwise, you don't have to give it up, and then you'll go to Vaikuntha.
Yes.
But if you want pure unalloyed, then that means...
Yeah. It depends uniquely to our own desire.
Yes. The point is, we're an individual, so therefore our relationship with God is individual.
And we can choose which place we want to go according to this.
Basically, you can choose the place, but then you have to act on that choice.
Yes.
Choice.
Of course.
There you go.
You're doing jnana or karma, and you go to Vaikuntha, that would seem to contradict the principle that you could only go there by pure devotional service.
But here's within pure, we're talking about pure or pure unalloyed. Like that. Because you're also having the element that you have to be able to accommodate within this level of theistic moralist that you're smart of. And they, like, let's say you have a family, traditionally they've always worshipped Vishnu. They will call themselves Vaishnavas. And technically you can't, from the general Shastra definitions, say that they're not. And they're either following their particular, you know, Pancharatric or Vedic or, you know, whatever is their particular line. They follow their Veda, they follow, and they're doing everything paka. People do exist like that. You know, so now they're doing all these things, but karma and jnana is the predominance. So if there is that kind of faith in the Lord, then it can turn into they go to Vaikuntha. Then you have those who are not smart, because they're committed to that. So it's pure devotion. It means they've given up the mundane. But here, when we say pure unalloyed, it means it's not, we haven't given up the aspects of that it's the interactions that we're interested in, or the form of the interactions, or the form of that knowledge of the Lord. In other words, one very much appreciates doing that particular activity for the Lord, as opposed to one wants to serve the Lord, please the Lord through that particular activity. It's a very subtle difference. It's a difference between the pure devotion and pure unalloyed. You know, or between, you know, what's Vaikuntha and what's Vrindavan. It's very subtle, because you do have, it means within Dwarka, there you have elements of that more personal aspect. You know, or in Mathura. But Mathura, when Krishna walks in, he has four arms. But it has somehow or another that intimacy, and some elements of the intimacy and all that, certain spontaneity that you see in Vrindavan. You know, so it's a very unique kind of place. But we see with time that manifests as Dwarka.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't hear much of the pastimes in Mathura. You hear a lot of what goes on in Dwarka. Because there it's kind of like that place in between where Vaikuntha meets Vrindavan. You know. But then you also have the elements of Vrindavan where people appreciate the pastimes of Vrindavan, but as still through rules and regulations. So that's lower Goloka. It's not talked about much, because for us it's not very important. But it's brought out so that one doesn't make the mistake that I'm doing something that's just kind of connected to Vrindavan, so therefore it's exactly the same as what Rupa Goswami is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make the distinction that the reason you're doing is to please Krishna. In the beginning you're doing because it's the rule, but ultimately it has to be because it pleases Krishna. Yeah. That's the difference between rag and vaidhi. So the vaidhi has the element of that comfortableness within that. Because you get into Vrindavan, even if you practice vaidhi here for your whole life, then when you get to the liberated platform, get to Bhava, then you'll start Rag. But for the Vaikuntha-vasis, when they get to the platform of Bhava, they don't start Rag. It's always going to be Vaidhi. There may be a more more regulated form and a more broad form of Vaidhi, as we'll see the year after next, when we deal with Gopa Kumar, is that there are more mature residents of Vaikuntha that can accommodate Gopa Kumar's interaction with Vishnu. Because they know that he has Vrindavan pastimes and does all that. So they can accommodate that our Lord does all these kinds of things, because he's Lord, he does everything. While others, no, this is how it's done in Vaikuntha, it's got to be done like this. So they can't accommodate, they get bent out of shape.
In Vaikuntha?
Huh?
They get bent out of shape in Vaikuntha? Or before they get
there? No, this is there. You know, in other words...
So they put him in place when he's there?
They mentioned to him stuff, and so then, you know, like that. But then the senior one said, don't worry about it, you know. Because the point is you have all these aspects of relationship. See, that's the difficulty, is that it's very exact. Just the idea is that, oh, no, it'll all just happen. You know, that's the thing. No, you have faith that you know automatically happens, but it's according to what is the taste. Because Krishna reciprocates your taste. And that's all. What is the taste of oh, it'll just happen? You know what I'm saying? It's just, oh, we'll just be good, and when we get there, it'll all work out. What is that? How do you reciprocate that? What does he work out? Because all you're interested in is karma. So that's why when they present heaven, it's all basically just nice karma. It's good karma, is what we call the heavenly planets. Just the difference is, you know, you won't necessarily be there with your same family members. You know, though you can have the element that if husband and wife are very committed to each other, they could go to heaven together, like that. But you know, then all the other relos, you know, that may not, you know.
So you're saying in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, just by following, being Rupa Nugas, following the Goswamis, when we get to Bhava, naturally, it'll be Raga. We'll practice Raga Nuga Sadhana.
You'll have to take it up. It means you'll have to convert to that. Right? There is a conversion process. You have to, because the point is you'll go in as you came out here, just freed from conditioning. But the consciousness will be the same. As you thought of Krishna at the time of death, that's where you'll start. But you still have to then come to the... If it wasn't spontaneous at that time, you have to come to the spontaneous part. But that's what everybody else is doing. So it's just natural. If that's what you want, it's just, it will happen. It's just a matter of how quickly. So we see when Krishna played the flute, then so many gopis went. So that means they had already taken up the association of the Nitya Siddhas and developed that mood. So they went. Then those who got stopped, they hadn't quite. But in that moment of being stopped, the intensity of that burned up whatever, you know, elements are left from the time in the material world, the piety and impiety that's left. And so then they went. But the group that got stopped and didn't go, that meant they were less divine. But by being stopped, then the intensity of their meditation on Krishna burnt everything up, and they went at the next rasa dance. So it's going to work, it's just a matter of understanding it, why get stopped. That's the point.
I was kind of thinking also, when a devotee comes to the stage of nishtha, or the stage of Ruchi, and he's not practicing Vaidhanuga Bhakti, or even higher. Should he think, well, something's...
So higher is Prema.
Well, I mean, same Bhakti or Bhakti.
But in Bhava, it's still Raganuga. It's just you don't have the conditioning deal. There, that's real Raganuga. This Raganuga is in line of, it's you could say it's Rag, you know, Rag Anuga Anuga, you know, like that.
So if he's not doing Rag Anuga in that stage, should he think everything's cool and when I get to Baba?
The point is
do it then?
It's more of if he's thinking about it, then what's the considerations? You know what I'm saying? The point is that someone may never think about it, but as soon as it comes up as something to think about, then it should be considered. Otherwise, how does he know it's real? You know, because Krishna's rag means that you're spontaneous about it. We take it spontaneous. This is the problem. We take it that spontaneous means whimsical. So then that becomes, how do you control that? Or it means gopi bhava club. One of these two, which neither of them is the definition of raganuga bhakti. So therefore then raganuga bhakti gets a bad name. Though it's a standard word used. You know, Prabhupada maybe used the English spontaneous devotional service more. But devotees throw it out as if it's bogus. So if Prabhupada's recommending raganuga bhakti, and at the same time not recommending gopi bhava club, so what is exactly he recommending? So that's the point, is it has to be thought about. You don't think about it, don't worry about it. But if you think about it, then think about it correctly. You're just like little kids, don't think about boy-girl relationships. You don't worry about it, it's cool. But, you know, the day they wake up to it, then they better think about it correctly. Otherwise, then they'll do all kinds of stupid stuff. That's all.
So we're all going to wake up one day thinking about it?
At some point. It's just a matter of when. The point is you know it's there. So it's just a matter of when it naturally happens. It's not a matter of force or practice. You can't practice raganuga bhakti. You know what I'm saying? It's there are practices on the platform of raganuga bhakti, but it's not a practice to get you to raganuga bhakti. Vaidhi is the practice that gets you to rag. But the point is you have to be open to the idea that rag is okay and actually know what rag is. Like Prabhupada defines it as that, just that being, you know, spontaneous in service. Right? But some groups will say, no, that's not actually. It's, and you have to specifically try to follow in the footsteps of a particular group, particular things, read about that all the time and all that. But Bhaktivinoda defines that, and he's very freely talks about Sarup Siddhi and Raganuga and all those. But when he gets into the detail, then we see is that detail happens in the third stage of Bhav Sadhana. When you're liberated, that's where it happens. So when Rupa Goswami makes the point of anartha nivritti, you start practicing raganuga sadhana, that it, in its primary form, that means bhava. Because then anartha nivritti, you've gotten rid of all the anarthas there. There is no conditioning. Right? Now it's just a matter of you haven't developed the positive. You've gotten rid of all the negative. But the secondary form is nishta. Because if you look at it, where's the real nishta? At the point of nishta before bhava? Or bhava, is that more nishta? Because you don't have a conditioning to distract you. So in other words, everything is parallel. You know, so it has its natural forms.
I would often think ruchi would be the... So ruchi, because it's natural, there's a natural taste, it's more spontaneous.
That's there, but that's the middle stage of the money. Because there, then it goes very nicely. See, because you have a lot more. See, there's they're very simple explanations, but if you understand them in principle, don't get distracted by the detail, then it expands nicely into the detail. Because the point is Shraddha, through Shraddha, you know, up to Bhava, is powered by Bhava. It's not powered by something else. Sadhana Bhakti is not powered by a different thing. It's Bhava, it's just that it's so minimally manifest, it's not called ecstasy. Right? That's all. You know. And so where you actually start to see it become more prominent is with ruchi. So the elements of that taste or that ecstasy extends down to ruchi. But the power of the devotional process in attracting you to Krishna, the rati, that goes all the way down to Shraddha. So that's what's actually going on. So, you know, to be able to... Then these are just showing so the progresses that are going on, because it's over all this, but when one doesn't understand devotees, doesn't associate nicely, one's distracted easily by material desire, that's called the neophyte. When that becomes steady, you're able to deal with devotees nicely, you're stable in your devotional service, that's called the madhyama. The only difference is the prominence of the material desires over spiritual. You're a devotee, you want Krishna and everything, but not that much that you're willing to cooperate. That's what we were saying before. They're bringing up the Christian elements. Is they're happy and comfortable to be a neophyte. And even that, not a very well-trained, very knowledgeable neophyte. And that's good enough. But then how can that just be good enough? You know what I'm saying? You know, Jesus was always thinking about, always preaching. Everything in his life was about that. Even if he's sitting on the side of the road and people are coming by, you know, with some, you know, local village entertainment, they're going to stone some lady to death. You know, still he's involved. He didn't go, oh, this is too much, or, you know, this and that, or get moralistic or anything. He was just talking philosophy. So, you know, okay, you guys are saying this is bad. We're not saying it's not bad, but the problem is that. Are any of you, his point is this, adjudication should be done by somebody who's good, not somebody who's bad. So are any of you here good enough to actually throw the stones? And if you are, hey, you know, Shastra recommends it, go for it. And so then they all drop their stones and go. Like that. So it's just a matter, he's always talking about this, always, it's like that. So wouldn't that be the natural thing? The apostles are always talking, always living, so wouldn't that be a proper Christian? So that's the thing, is that so between the apostolic and what you have today, a lot's been lost on how to actually connect it all to God. Right? So that's the thing, is that the Vedantic philosophy shows how to do it. So then, if you actually want to develop love for God, why wouldn't you take advantage of the science?
Because it's of the devil.
Means, who came up with the iPhone? You know, it's like, you know, Jesus showed up one day and said, you know, here's an iPhone, you know, multiply and prosper or something. You know, I mean, what does that mean? So it's very, how do you say, whimsical, what's the devil and what's not. Because today, science, certain aspects of science aren't the devil. But 1,000 years ago, they were as devil as you can get. So that's what I'm saying, is that how does it change? So does that mean, who's the real Krishna? Are the guys today off track and before they were real, or they were off track and now today they're real? I mean, who's the real Krishna? Where is the line? Where's the consistency? Where's the parampara? So the point is the Vedic literature can show you how to bring it into proper line. You really want to develop love for God, this is the way you're going to do it. You know, they don't mind taking help from, you know, modern industry to make money to take care of their family. So then why is that not the devil? I mean, there's plenty of people that say industry is the devil or money is the devil. So, you know, why do they choose? So basically it comes down to what you don't have the capacity to understand or learn is the devil. That's the bottom line. So that means whoever happens to be in the superior authority or a position, either in the council or, you know, an individual head, or just in the local, you know, parish, whatever they aren't able to accommodate, then it's the devil. You know? And therefore ecumenical councils, so that they, you know, have a common definition of the devil. So, but that's not very enlightened. That's not very intellectual or thoughtful. And the faith, the point is the faith is in God. What do you care about the devil? Like that. How is the devil a problem? If you have faith in God, the devil's not a problem. But they make, you know, so much out of the devil. And God doesn't come here. God's not controlled. The devil's here, and you're quite comfortable making a position and life and everything here in the devil's kingdom. But somehow or another, you know, you're going to heaven. It doesn't make sense. Right? Means you're thinking of God, and that you'll go to heaven. The devil, you know, if he's the way you say is, he's thinking of God, you know, and he's here, why won't he go to heaven? Things just. Okay. Actually, there are only two types of realization of the Lord. That of realizing the Lord's majestic form, and Mahima Jnana Rupa, and his pure form, Kevala Jnana Rupa. The inhabitants of Vaikuntha, endowed with realization of the Lord and pure opulence, see the form of Narayan, the Supreme Lord of all unlimited verses, universes. Whereas those endowed with the vision of the Lord in opulence mixed with pure knowledge, Kevala Misra, see Krishna as the Lord of Mathura and Dwarka. Those endowed with pure realization, Siddhi Kevala Jnana, see Krishna, the Lord of Raja. The difference between these two realizations is ever existent in the Lord himself. Not only at the time of sadhana are the differences seen, they persist in the spiritual world. So that was the point there. In the spiritual world, the same kind of vision is there. It means the person here, the soul here, is what goes back to Godhead. The conditioning gets left. But the point is, it's not the conditioning whether you like Vaishnavas or not, or are committed to your, you know, devotional service or not. That's the soul. Conditioning is, you know, if I'm not committed to God, what I'm going to do with my spare time. Like that. That's the thing. So, depending upon what it is. You know, like my one devotee, you know, would say Narayan a lot. You know, he would say Narayan. And I'd say, well, aren't you worried that, you know, you'll go to Vaikuntha instead of Vrindavan? And he said, well, what's the difference? It's all the spiritual world. It's, you know, just as long as you get out of this material world, it's fine. So that's the point. He'll only go to Vaikuntha. Or if there is that little touch of there, maybe Mathura or Dwarka.
It seems a lot of times Prabhupada would refer to Vaikuntha. He wouldn't particularly say Raj or Goloka, Vrindavan.
But what's the view that you're looking at it? It's just like, let's say the mother is talking to her friends about her son's, you know, latest recognition, you know, in his whatever he's doing as a, let's say, a high court judge, right? So they're talking about, yeah, you know, this is so powerful, so influential, and, you know, and he's done so many great things. But in the mother's mind, who's she talking about? The son, not a judge. So that's the whole, when we talk about Vaikuntha, it's just one of the opulences of Krishna. The gopis have no problem talking about pastimes of Vaikuntha, because it's Krishna is doing it. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole point, is they don't have any problem accommodating. The idea is that you have to be able to, it's like this. This is, how you say it? A very key subject. And after explaining it, then one can understand Krishna's position of that, you know, that contrary position of achintya, being able to do the impossible, two contradictory impossible things functioning at once. Right? Okay. So, the one is that the husband is under the complete control of the wife. If it's complete control, then she's satisfied that security is there. She can always depend upon him. But at the same time, if he's under complete control, then what's more to conquer? What's more to win? What more is there? Because, you know, the nature is to expand. So then, what is more to conquer? Right? So then, if the man is only that much, she'll lose interest. So therefore, simultaneously, he has to be his own personality with his own interests and own activities that he's doing. But at the same time, it doesn't compromise his surrender to the wife. So he has that complete independence that has basically nothing to do with her. At the same time, as there's nothing lost here. The problem comes is if the work takes more prominence here, or the surrender takes more prominence than his individuality. Because the generally guy is independent, does whatever he wants, then he meets the girl, then they start to adjust, and all the things that are different is what's the problem, so he starts to give all those up, and then when they're fully given up, then the lady gets bored. So the thing is how to maintain those at the same time that surrender. Now you can understand how God is successful with women, and here it's more of a problem. Right? Because God is a chintya. We're not necessarily so achintya. Huh? Yeah, smell it, Jinkin.
We're chinti in our madness. I think there was one philosopher who said that there's two things unlimited, the universe and people's insanity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
People's stupidity.
Yeah. Does that make sense? So the whole point is, therefore, the gopis don't have any problem that he has this whole other scene that he does. As long as when he's with them, he's completely surrendered. Like that. So that's the problem, is we have a particular idea of what Raganuga looks like. But it's beyond our mental concoction. It has to, that understanding has to descend from the spiritual world. Like that. And it's by Krishna's grace. Then it's appreciated. So here we have the Mahima and Kevala. You know, so you have the Kevala Misra, which is then, so the Siddhi Kevala and the Kevala Misra. So that, therefore, we see the Mahima is going to be, means if it's realization dominated by karma, realization by jnana, or by either of those, that will place you in Vaikuntha. So in other words, the focus is on the knowledge and activities. So they've given up the material and they're performing Naishkarmya. So that will get them out of the material world. But that taste for worshiping the Lord through those forms is the, you know, in other words, the greatness and all that. Because it's knowledge that he's great and the activities are great and everything's great. Like that. So that's there. So that'll place you in Vaikuntha. Pure realization, that will place you in Vrindavan. Right? Now, if you have a mix of those, that will put you in Mathura Dwarka. So whether there's more on that taste of the the experience of it, or more on the form of it, then that will be the difference between Mathura and Dwarka. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then there's only the one. He's mentioning it's there's only not only the difference between it is ever existing in the Lord Himself, because there is these natures. So the higher one can accommodate the lower one has trouble accommodating the higher.
So is a ISKCON devotee, if he wakes up one day in Vaikuntha, is he going to say, oh, bummer, I got to the wrong place? Or he would never,
the point
never
is
end up there?
Basically means if he's careful, he'll never end up there. But that's why Raghunath Das Goswami makes the point, be very careful not to meditate upon these things and all that, because then you might end up there. Because the point is if you're thinking about it and it's just part of, you know, Krishna's, you know, how Krishna expands and how he does everything, and so you're seeing everything in relation to Krishna, there's not a problem. That's just what goes on in Vaikuntha. But if it's like, well, that would be interesting, that would be nice, that's a problem.
You know, sometimes I think in my position, I think, okay, I want to go to Braj. And sometimes I think, oh, what if I ended up in Vaikuntha? That would be horrible. And then I'm thinking, but am I just, is that weird for me to think that way? That would be, because I'm not such a great devotee, and I'm thinking...
The point, but the thing is the soul is pure. So it's not about, the standard is not the conditioning. The standard is the soul. So what does the soul want? You know, because the point is, what is the qualification anyway? Because to have that interaction with God who's unlimited, what would be the tattva of that? Unless it's just the desire for it. You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say you have a gathering. And, you know, let's put it in the Western context, it goes more smoothly. You know, it's basically kind of a party, you know, and everybody's there. And so, you know, and it's more of a proper party, it's a formal party. And so everybody's following the rules and this and that. And, you know, the various individuals see other individuals they find attractive and all that. But, you know, all the rules are there, right? Now, if everybody's just playing the rules, then eventually, you know, down the lines, you know, it kind of works out. But now one person is just much more, how you say, has more chutzpah, right? So they step beyond the regular rules, but not in a way to disturb everything. You know, it means, you know, you go around the corner in the next room, no one's there, then he's much more aggressive or different things like that. So it will seem that it's not good, but who in the end ends up with the girl? That guy or the guys that are just doing all the formal and everything? And, you know, in other words, they don't have that spontaneous aspect. So even though it's not, he's not any more qualified, in fact, he could possibly be even less qualified. But who actually gets it? So it's actually based on desire. So even those other guys that are very formal, if they have very strong desire, they'll work it out very formally. So it's actually about desire. You know, because they was there at the formal party, and then after that, then it, nothing happened there, and so nothing happened. But the guy, even he's formal, he'll see, you know, send some flowers, he'll do something, you know, send gifts, you know, make invitations. So the girl knows, here's desire. And the other guys may have looked good, but then, you know, no desire. So the ultimate point is that the jiva is, well, what's the qualification? Right? So the only qualification is simply the desire for it. So Braja Bhakti, the only qualification for Braja Bhakti is the desire for it. That's what I'm saying. If we're saying it's Raga Nuga, there is no Vaidhi for it. You know what I'm saying? This is the big joke. Most people who are involved in quote-unquote Raga Nuga Bhakti are actually just doing Vaidhi Bhakti, but just focused on the gopis, that's all. It's, there's no ifs, ands, or buts that there's anything Raga Nuga about it. Because we ask them, no, you have to read about the gopis. If you have to, that's Vaidhi. You know what I'm saying? That's all. So they don't even catch what Vaidhi is. I mean, Raga Nuga is, because they don't know what Vaidhi is. So it's just, the point is it's just like, it means, let's say you want to teach someone how to ride a bicycle, there's specific things you do, right? And you have to follow that, but once you know how to ride the bicycle, you ride it wherever you want, however you want. That's wrong. But Vaidhi means, you know, just as it was very formal learning how to, it, when you ride the bicycle, you're very formal about it. You maintain that. So that's the method of expression. That's Vaikuntha. So it's not even understood what Raga Nuga is. You know? So it's a matter of taste and desire. It's not a matter of a particular form. It's not because I have all the books about, you know, all, you know, that could be used in that way. Therefore, I'm more of a Raga Nuga. It shows that there are some desire, yes. But it's not the books that generally indication, that's not the thing. It's the desire. So the point is if you think you're exclusive, then that's pride, that's false ego. So you're cultivating the rag part, but you're allowing the weed of the false ego to grow at the same time.
What about the statement, first deserve, then desire?
That's there, so then, but the point is you have to prove that you're actually trying. Now the Goswamis, are they living a lifestyle that you could say that this would be what would be recommended for serious practicing Krishna consciousness? Yes. But in their prayer, they say, I'm unqualified, I'm shameless, but I still want Raja Bhakti. I don't have any quality, but I still want it. So the point is within the heart, you have to want that, but externally, you have to follow the sadhana. Otherwise, how do you know you're sincere? Does that make sense? Like that. So it's a balance.
Ashabandha.
Yeah. That's what he said, you know, Lala Samai, all those things, those are all the things there, but that's all kind of like goes out the window, because if you throw out Raga Nuga, you throw out everything, then what are you left with? Bureaucracy. You know, so there's nothing else. That's what devotional service is about. Otherwise, what's the meaning of Sarva Dharma Parityaja? I mean, of course, every temple president uses it to get anybody to do anything they want, but that's not actually what the point of the verse is. That actually, that get him to do what you want, is its third chapter, is that you have a duty as a human being, and therefore this is the way we express that duty. You know, so they're using the wrong chapter, but it's effective. And it's used in Krishna's service, so hey, it works. You know, all spirit, and love, and war, right? You know. But if you're being technical, it's third chapter that they have to use.
So that's Ragmarg, Sarvadharma Parityaja?
That's the point. Because Krishna's first, then the activity. But below that, it's the activity and then Krishna. It means I'm performing the activity and it's for Krishna. Or I want to please Krishna, so I perform an activity that can please Krishna. And so, me in my position, what activity could I perform? So, therefore, since I'm not the body has a conditioning, and that conditioning has certain skills, so I'll use those skills to please Krishna. So externally it looks exactly the same. That's the fun part. We think it looks different. That's from the impersonal. Because impersonalism, if it's, you know, spiritual, has to be the opposite of material. Right? So therefore, Vaidhi is you know, the lower and Rag's the higher. Therefore, Rag must be whimsical. Now, it looks exactly, from the outside, you can't tell the difference. Right? Means you have the intelligent wife who is faithful to her husband, and the intelligent wife who's not. Do they look different? No. That's the point. So if they drop the Vaidhi, that's not actual Raganuga. Because the point is, Vaidhi is the cover for Raganuga.
But they call it Raganuga Sadhana.
Yeah. Like Vaidhi Sadhana. Raganuga Sadhana. It's one thing. It's Sadhana. And it's just the Vaidhi aspect of it and the Rag aspect. That's the problem. They don't know enough Sanskrit.
It seems paradoxical to use the word Raga and Sadhana together.
You use Bhav Sadhana also. One means the same Sadhana continues on the platform of Bhava. Sadhana stops at Prema. When you get to Prema, then no more Sadhana. Sadhana simply means practice. So Rag is a practice also. But what's the form of that practice? Vaidhi. In other words, Vaidhi is the form of it. There's a mentality to go with it, but even if you don't have the mentality, you can still perform Vaidhi. But if you don't have the mentality, you can't perform Rag, because it's not a form. It's a mentality. So then when the Vaidhi, you know, you practice that, but even if you're not, whatever it is, you're practicing it. So, but when that spontaneous mood arises, whenever it arises, because you can't make it arise, because then you're saying that karma produces bhakti.
But we always hear this, we should develop this greed for it, and
yes,
that's what will make it.
Yeah, but how are you going to express the greed? It's just like this. Let us say, you know, there's a bunch of cookies, okay? And there's a few people in the room. And you have greed. How do I know you have greed?
I'm eating all the cookies.
Right. So therefore, that's how you see the greed. He's doing all the service, all the preaching, all the managing, all the cooking, all of this. He's going for it. But, you know, but we're talking about, you know, the vacation, the you can be the temple president, you also get, you know, you get a house and dental, you know, and stuff like that. Where's the greed? Where's the greed? You know, I'll do that because it's secure, but if that wasn't offered, then I just continue my karmic job and all that because there's more security. Where's the greed? You know, the point is, you know, it's not, you know, if it just becomes reduced down to management and doing this and that, then the point of the devotional process has been missed. But at the same time, it's better they're doing that in devotional service than not doing devotional service. But the point is, because mixed is better than nothing. Because mixed means there's progress. Because you've added pure devotion to your already karmic position. So it's mixed. But the idea is, if pure isn't what strive for, then how is it going to be inspired? Ordinary is not inspiring. Right? It's just not. So there has to be that dynamic element. You know? So the point is, first deserve, then desire. The point is that are you fully engaged? If you are, then naturally then that desire is going to arise. Because if you're just having the desire without the deserving it, it's probably not the real desire. There's some other motive for having the desire. You know? It's just like, let us say you have somebody who's very sick. And, you know, so the taste is not there, they can't tolerate much. Okay, now I give him some pretty, you know, regular stuff. And he'll taste it, and there's not much taste. Let us say I give some real high-end connoisseur kind of stuff. There'll be a touch more taste in it, but how much more? Right? That's the point, is that if someone was healthy, the difference between those would be like night and day. So then, of course, if they sit around and read about the gopis, there's something there, at least for the first few months or few years. But, you know, where are they now? You know what I'm saying? So the ones who were doing that before and are still doing it today, those are the real ones. But if it was only a fad, a fashion, you know, like that, you know, then, you know, then where's it meaning? Where's the qualification? You know, it's like that example Prabhupada gave of that one factory in Calcutta, that it was taken over by the Muslim, right? And so the guy who even told he shouldn't still is wearing the tilak, then he's the one that can do it. Because it was because of his determination and faith. Because he would lose his job, lose everything. But these others, is, you know, what are they going to lose? You know, what's the risk? So the risk has to be that you're willing to give up your material attachments. You know, otherwise this whole, you know, get together all around like this and that, and then, you know, all the families come together. You know, kids are playing in the next room, and adults get into some serious kirtan and stuff like that. And then afterwards they go home to their house and this and that. What's this raga nuga thing? What are they talking about? You know what I'm saying? So the point is it's real. But the thing is Prabhupada didn't want anything that was not real. In Vaidhi it's safe, even if it's mixed, it still has efficacy. But rag can't really be mixed. So therefore you don't have, you know, rag abbas, you know, like that. It's just, you rag abbas is Vaidhi. In other words, the emotional aspect of bhava has come up, rather than just the activities. If just the activities are there, that's the vaidhi. If the mood is there, that's the rag. When they're properly combined in the proper balance, that's bhava. You know? Because it's not, you're doing the same activities when ruchi comes. You don't change the activities. It's just now the taste you get is greater. You may waste less time. If you have an opportunity, you'll chant more, or, you know, whatever is giving you taste. But it's not that you change the activities. You haven't changed the conditioning. You still have the same nature. But it's just now you utilize your time for that taste. Does that make sense? So it's a very nice thing, but it has to be understood correctly. So, you know, like that. So one has to be very, very careful, because you don't want the sahajya out.
We're always hearing the idea that you focus on the resident of Braj, and that's how you'll, it's like,
no, but first
before
you
have it, that's how you'll get it. That's one of the things.
Yes, but what does it mean, focusing on a resident of Vrindavan?
following their footsteps.
And what does that mean?
You want to develop that rag.
And what is that rag based on?
Based on your inclination for it, perhaps?
No, is it something, because now you're bringing it back to yourself, because it was focused on the other person. What is that rag that they have?
Prema.
Okay. So then it's about an generic attitude is the first place. You know what I'm saying? See, in other words, this is the point, is that I'll just jump from my conditioned viewpoint to, let's say, the viewpoint of, you know, Rupa or Rati or, you know what Vishwanath is doing like this. Nice. But the point is those are the activities they're doing. So is Vrindavan all about the activities? It's all about the mood. So you first, if you want to do that, you first have to, you know, have the mood. Just like if I say, you know, yes, you should ride a bicycle. So now does that infer I don't get the bicycle, I put the stand up, I hold the handlebars, I put my foot on the pedal, I put the other foot over the bike onto the other pedal, and then I push on the thing. And I'm paying attention, not running into things, not running over old ladies and stuff like that. Is that what it means? So when you say following the footsteps of the resident Vrindavan, what did it take to get there? So they're saying, no, we'll just go out, get on a bicycle and ride. What do you mean you get on a bike? You don't know how to ride a bicycle. You know, there's a good chance you don't even know what a bicycle is. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, is that the first stage in Bhav Sadhana, it means in this Raga Nuga Sadhana, you can say, is that you have to catch the mood of that surrender of the residents of Vrindavan, that 100% surrender. That's the first thing. Right? Then to be able to associate with the residents of Vrindavan, then you can follow in the footsteps of specifically Vrajavasi. So if you don't catch the mood, you don't accept Vrajavasis, then how are you going to focus on one person? So if you ignore other Vrajavasis and just go only to the gopis, then how you've understood Vrindavan? But you know, Radharani doesn't like Mother Yashoda. You know? So one has to actually understand what that means. You know, it's just like you're saying, yes, when my son grows up, he'll take over the business. So all he has to do is eat enough food and not get run over by a truck, and then he'll take over the business, just like that, walk in one day in his Armani suit, and now he's the man. You know what I'm saying? This is a process. So that means you have to follow the forms of devotional service we do are the forms that they do in the spiritual world. Okay, gopis, they go out to the Jamuna, collect water for that. Don't we collect water for the bath? Like that, you know, collect all the towels and all the clothes and then bathe them nicely in nice oils. We don't use those in our puja? You know, it's like, where did that come from? Like that, you know, drying them, decorating them with tilak, putting flowers and other things like that, offering nice foodstuffs. You know, that's the same thing we're doing. But the point is we're doing because we're supposed to. They're doing because they want to. So that's why that's Braj, and what we're doing is Vaikuntha. You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. The judge, or let's say, or even just take lawyers, because it may not be able to fraternize with the lawyers so much, the judge. But other, you know, say your high court lawyers, you know, high-end lawyers like that. Now, there's another, he's just a colleague. And so if the one lawyer sees you, another lawyer is a colleague, how do you reciprocate? As a colleague. Now, you know, something he catches and that, you know, hey, that I can relate to that, comes over, you start talking as just person to person, no lawyer business. Then you can become a friend. So he'll remain as a colleague unless you deal with him as a friend. So the same way as Radha Krishna manifests to us as Lakshmi Narayan, because we're dealing with him as Lakshmi Narayan. As soon as we deal with Radha Krishna, he'll be Radha Krishna. So when Prabhupada says we're worshiping Lakshmi Narayan, it doesn't mean that we're worshiping Lakshmi Narayan Vaikuntha. We're worshiping Radha Krishna, but they're in the mood of Lakshmi Narayan because that's the mood that we're worshiping now. So that's the point. So now a resident of Vrindavan who sees Radha and Krishna as Radha and Krishna can offer the arti to Radha and Krishna, but they're in the material world. So they you see them follow the nicely the rules because that's what you do here. You know, it's etiquette. Like that. It's etiquette. When the girls are by themselves, they sit and talk in one way. But if, let's say, you know, an older, you know, elder gopi walks into the room, they sit differently, talk differently. If a man walks into the room, even more differently. And that's in Vrindavan. So what do you mean? It's just the way it works.
But what if a devotee at a certain point says, I don't want to worship as Lakshmi Narayan anymore, I want to worship as Radha and Krishna?
Then it's called prema. So if you worship in prema, it's Radha and Krishna. No problem.
Before that?
Go for it.
Before that?
The point is it's Radha Krishna in that mood, because it's just, if you want, the worship will be exactly the same. The ritual and the mantras will be exactly the same. It's the attitude in which you're doing it. Are you doing it to please them, or just because you like rituals, or because, you know, this is what you have to do, or, you know, in other words, the form doesn't change. Right? Just like, let's say, yeah. The form doesn't change. What's the difference between, let's say you go to a restaurant, okay, we'll just take it that your mother's a good cook, okay? And you go to a restaurant, and they're also as equally good cooks. But the taste in the food in the restaurant, the taste at home is different. Why? Because of the attitude. The technique is exactly the same. Things go in a pot, you put it on the fire, you push it around a bit, you take it off. So it's the attitude which makes the difference. So the activities of the 16, it's constantly referred to in the Goswami's literature, the gopis worshiping Krishna with the 16 items of worship. That's where it comes from. It's just 16 varieties of ways of interacting and pleasing Krishna. And that 16 then becomes elaborated, so it becomes 64. So it takes the whole day. Does that make sense? Like asana, you give the Lord a place to sit. So that's the formal within the 16. But then you have Paryankasana, where he sits in a place where he can relax. You know, it's more of a couch kind of scene. Shayanasana means he goes to sleep. But it's all asana. Like that. You know, the boga, it's one thing. You know, you have the boga, but it could be a full meal, could be a snack, could be just some, you know, some fruit, it could be something, you know, like that. So like that, the 16 is the form, and from that it expands. They do make a seat for Krishna. They're there decorating with flowers to make a nice place for Radha and Krishna. That's asana, right? They invite him to the asana. Once they're there, they see that they're comfortable. That's swagatam. So all these things go on. But it's thought, no, it must be something different. Everything comes from Brahma. If we're saying the original person, Krishna, is there, he expands the Swarup Shakti, which is the complete, and that interaction, that's the Adi Rasa. So the manifestation of that then happens within Braj. Then Braj expands the Mathura as Dwarka, Dwarka is Vaikuntha. And then this is reflected into the material world. So the point is by the think of the rule of cause and effect, you won't have an effect that doesn't have its origin in the cause. So if we have pancharatric worship here, that's because there is an original 16 items of worship there. Just there it's done in natural spontaneity. Here it's done in the formality. So the difference will be is your attitude, not the worship itself. The worship won't change one bit. It's in the attitude. So, in other words, yes, if you want to do that, then be conscious that this is Krishna you're worshiping. And you're doing it to please him. That you're standing there and you're, you know, instead of just, you know, instead of standing there right in the middle and offering the artik and all your ecstasy, now this is the Bab. But the point is that there's devotees on the other side. Krishna would like to see the devotees. So then you're not actually aware of Krishna. You're aware about the Bab I'm getting from worshiping Krishna. Right? So therefore, then you stand to the side. You know, like that. You know, it should look professional when you do the Arctic. Therefore, you put the paraphernalia nicely. It should be clean. Therefore, it's the way you place it so that you don't contaminate one with the other. You know, so you do all those things. It's to please Krishna. That's the way he likes it. You know, Krishna washes his hands, mouth, and feet before he eats. So when they cook, they do the same thing. Before they offer it, they do the same thing. So in other words, the cooks are clean. The ones serving prasad are clean. The ones eating prasad are clean. That's how Krishna likes it. And we're always, now, why do I have to wash my feet? You know, why does I eat? I guess feet are just very far away or something. You know, but it's always the feet. Right? I surmise that's because in third grade they didn't show you the movie of all the bacteria that you have to wash your hands after going to the toilet. Right? So therefore no one has a problem with washing their hands. But no one wants to wash their mouth or their feet. And the only reason they'll wash their mouth after eating is because that's what they told you also. I think in the fourth grade, then they introduced the thing about brushing your teeth. Like that, how you brush after every meal and this and that and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So devotees do brush their teeth afterwards because of that, or they wash their hands because of that. But washing the feet and washing, rinsing the mouth, that's fanatic, right? It takes less time to rinse your mouth 16 times with water than it does to get out the toothbrush and all that and to carry that around. But somehow or another, washing your mouth 16 times, that's fanatic, but brushing your teeth, that's just perfectly normal. And if we're talking about being efficient in time, I think the other one's more efficient. Of course, you don't have the minty fresh, but then that's why you have, you know, the mukshruti and those kind of things. How do you get minty fresh without having to use toothpaste?
Yes? I once heard a prophet say, he said, wash your mouth before you eat. It's after you eat, you still have prasadam in it. And he will spit out all the prasadam.
Yeah. But you'd see him at the last, when he, after the last bite, then he sips some water and rinses his mouth. So that when he rinsed his mouth, the shot didn't go all over. Yeah. But there is introduction, you see in some very early letters in that, when people aren't necessarily following standards and stuff like here in India, that he would tell them to brush their teeth twice a day, because at least then their mouth would get cleaned. And he would say that they would have to wash their thighs, you know, with soap when they take a shower after using the toilet, because they, you know, they're sitting on the toilet, they're not squatting on the toilet. So if you're using it life, it means whatever the lifestyle, then you use that to its best. But then there is the superior ways of applying it. So it's just a matter of accommodation. You know, it's just like, does that make sense? You know, it's like Prabhupada's in the, what do you call those places? Who are they? The Agarwal's house, right? So they give him a little, you know, spot in their refrigerator, you know, and he's got his vegetarian boga there. And they got their meat and their leftovers and all, whatever it is, and the rest of it. So now, you know, he's making the best out of what you can do. So you have a little place there and you keep the nice things there. But then better than that would be, you know, all your non-veg, you know, and the veg would be in a different refrigerator. But then better than that is that the boga and the prasad would be in different refrigerators. So it's not that it doesn't have a standard. It's just that, you know, you deal with practically with what you got. But then if we say, oh, see there, Prabhupada didn't make this thing, so we don't have to make, no. He didn't make a distinction because that was the situation. Because there's a later letter then where he says that if in the deity place, you know, I mean in the temple or in your home, you can't make the distinction between prasad and boga, then how are you expressing this love for Krishna? How are you going to express that? Where's the love? Because Krishna likes them separate, but you don't want to separate them for your own self, so therefore... Does that make sense? So if prasad has to be kept in the refrigerator, then get another refrigerator. And if you say it's not practical, then why is the refrigerator not practical, but, you know, everything else is practical? You know, if you go into anybody's house, half the stuff they have is not actually important. You know? And it's probably, if you add it all up, you could buy five refrigerators for that money.
people, they just eat full prasada.
That's another thing. But I'm just saying, is my point is that the mood and being able to apply to the situation is what's important. So all it is that prema has been applied to all the situations. Almost prema, then it's like bhava. You know, kind of, you know, getting close, then that's the Madhyama platform. And just beginning, that's the neophyte platform. But it's the same attitude, the same activities are being tried for. But all it is that each level you show what it is that they could catch. So in other words, someone the first thing they can catch is the body. Right? The body, the ego. Right? And then you slowly introduce the mind. Like that. So when somebody first comes, you wash pots for Krishna. Right? And so then it works. Because they can relate to it. It's something to do with the body and the result, okay, it's for Krishna instead of for me. Like that. You know, so it works. And then slowly, slowly you introduce more and more detail. But the principle is, you know, I'm a devotee, if I'm this soul, I'm not the body, I'm servant of Krishna. Developing love for Krishna is the ultimate goal, and the process is through chanting and those activities in support of chanting. Right? And everything else expands from there. So the Brajabasis see themselves as servants of Krishna, but they just have a certain kind of love in that service of Krishna. So that's what makes them distinct from Dwarka, who also sees themselves as servant of Krishna, but the love they have identifies, therefore, the forms that they'll use to express the love will be different. And then Vaikuntha down from that. So it's a matter of, that's the essential point. That's what you have to catch. You catch that expands. If it's just, oh, we'll make him into vegetarian and then we'll work on devotion. That you miss the point. The point is devotion, the attitude. You know, that's what we see as Bhaktivinoda Thakur is going through here. He's not getting into any detail more than the attitude. He's just even expressed that Varnashram deals with the conditioned nature, and since everybody has to act according to their nature, Varnashram is going to be the best form to do that. It's the most scientific. Otherwise, how do you know who's supposed to? Should a businessman be running a hospital? No, why? Because medicine or health is not a matter of money. That should be available to everybody. Right? That's why then the Brahmin is doing the medical element. Then it will be cheap. It's easily available. Right? You know, in other words, you have the local doctor in a local town, and that he just charges what the people can afford. You know, and because it's private and no one sees, he sees that he may be charging different things for different people. More money for the rich guy and less money for the poor guy. You know, like that. But when you have a hospital, it's impersonal because that way, because the Vaishya doesn't want to deal with each case. He just wants his money. It's a trip to deal with each case. But for the Brahmin, it's about dealing with each case. It's about the person. So therefore, it'll be personal. The Vaishya, therefore, you have the hospital, you have the committee on top, and all it is, there's a receptionist, and this is the way it is. You like it, go. And if you don't like it, hey, hit the road. You understand? So that's why Varnashram is there, because the businessman should not be running a hospital. That's what happens when a businessman runs a hospital. That no one can afford it. That's the whole point. So that's why Varnashram. People say, oh, you get stuck, this, that. But everybody's stuck anyway. You're a white-collar worker, you're stuck there. You're a blue-collar worker, you're stuck there. You know what I'm saying? You're a lawyer, you know, you're in the firm. Okay, now if you want to move up, you want to be a partner, then you put in the time and effort for, you know, eternity. And then, you know, by the time you're about ready to drop dead, then they'll make you a partner. Right? But if after a couple of years you drop out, then now what are you going to do? Okay, you can go do whatever you want, but if you want to get back into law, then they're going to look, why you only work for this firm for this much time? And then disappeared, and then you weren't working for anybody else for 5 years. How can we take you seriously? So therefore, you are restricted. What is this nonsense that's not restricted? People who say this have no contact with reality. So Varnashram, it just makes it scientific, that's all. Okay, thank you.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki, Samaveda Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura.